I don't want to ditto what was said about the visitors who are among us this morning. We are always really encouraged being a smaller group when anyone passing through or stopping in Savannah prioritizes being with the church as you're traveling through. So really appreciate and so encouraged to hear your voices and song and just your presence and worship. And so I've mentioned this a few times with the last month's lessons here in December to finish out the year. But I was wanting to focus lessons on Jesus, and kind of as it has turned out, it's been lessons focused on maybe more unusual areas of Jesus's ministry and life that you wouldn't necessarily think it's very teachable, or there's just like a great deal of application practically from that particular section. And Matthew 1 is like that. This is a section that I think is easy even to kind of skip over sometimes because it's a lot of names, which Brandon read really, really well. And it can kind of be dismissed like, you know, Matthew, you know, he quotes the Old Testament a lot. So, you know, he has this here for Jews, and it proves Jesus really came from David and from Abraham, so that would have been important for a Jew. But the goal of this lesson is to try to draw out of this that there are many practical applications, many important things to draw from this, and even to a point where I hope to show through this lesson really clearly that more importance, that this genealogy holds greater importance for us than it would have for a physical Jew, right? And that even if Matthew, in his own thoughts writing this, was thinking this is important for a Jew, I would say God behind the scenes through inspiration by his Spirit is very mindful that this gospel is going to endure far longer than the Jewish system was going to endure for only maybe 20 or 30 more years after this gospel was written in the first place. So again, we're going to be thinking about the value of Jesus' genealogy here. And I want you to think, kind of before we read this again, at what point does someone's background in history really matter to you? Like, at what point is that something that you actually want to know? You know, that it's something that really impacts you when you get to know them better in that way. And I would argue that that would be in a covenant relationship, right? So like my wife and I, before we got married, as I'm sure has been the case for those of you who are married or have been married, that before you get married, there kind of gets to this point where you share details about your background that you probably have not shared with very many people, if not any people. And so there was a point where Eve and I shared things with each other that we really hadn't shared with really anyone. And usually those things are adversities that we had faced or things that we had done that were sinful, that we're just very ashamed of, and just felt like the person would have a better context of understanding kind of where we've come from and what's defined who we are now. So again, like when that begins to really matter is when you're entering into a covenant relationship. And what did Jesus come for? You know, did Jesus come so that we could just be friends with God at a distance? Or maybe have like a good familiarity with God, but again, kind of be in the crowd, you know, kind of see him from a distance? Well, obviously not, right? Jesus came for us to be able to enter into a covenant relationship with God. And so what does it do then, like when you're entering that covenant relationship, how does it like practically help you to know someone's detailed background? Like, why is that a helpful thing? Well, it's because it gives you a context for who that person is, right? It helps you love that person more, respect that person more. It helps you appreciate where they are now because of where they've come from. It helps you understand better how to interact with them. It helps you anticipate how they will react to things. And oftentimes, if it's someone who's been through a lot of adversity, or you kind of get a feel for the fact that they have a lot of experience dealing with any particular problem, it helps you have a greater deal of trust in that person, right? You know you can rely on them, or after kind of sharing those darker details, as often the case leading up to marriage, you know that you can confide in that person, right? They know the worst of you in the past, therefore they can for sure deal with the worst of you in the future as well, right? But it also helps you share their values. You know, you understand better, like, what really matters to them. You have a better basis for understanding how to talk with them, deal with them, share with them. And I would argue again that if we really love God, if we really understand who he is, those become things that we become very interested in. And if our interest is not to deeply know God in those ways, then it may be that we actually don't really know him at all, or don't really understand his love or his purpose or really Jesus's life and the purpose of his life, right? And I would argue again that this genealogy is an invitation not just to understand Jesus's background, but how that reflects him. So one scripture that I'm not going to have on the board just by way of introduction, keep your finger in Matthew 1 because we're going to read that in a second. Go to Luke chapter 24. For those of you who are members here, you've, I'm sure, heard me reference this, mention it many, many times. But look at Matthew or Luke 24. It's the last chapter of Luke, verse 27. This is where Jesus is risen from the dead. He's talking with two disciples about the fact that he just died. They don't know it's him. They don't recognize him physically, so they don't know that they're talking to Jesus. But suffice it to say, he's talking with them about the fact that he's just died, and they're very kind of discombobulated about how that could happen, and they're hearing people report that he's risen again, but they have not seen it. They don't really believe it. And so to clarify to them that this is exactly what they should have been expecting, and they should believe the people who talked about him being risen. In verse 27, you know, he leads up to this saying, you know, wasn't it necessary for the Christ to suffer these things and enter into his glory? Verse 27, then beginning with Moses and with all the prophets, he explained to them the things concerning himself in all the scriptures. Not some, not here and there. You know, according to Jesus, everything in the Old Testament is ultimately reflective of him. And as much as it would have been interesting to, like, hear him point by point go through how everything is reflective of who he is and what he would do, really that's an invitation to look at the Old Testament with enlightened eyes, right? With a new set of eyes. That we're to understand that the Old Testament, that narrative, the law teaching, the poetry, the prophecy, all of those things ultimately are reflections of who Jesus is, right? So back to Matthew chapter 1, 1 through 17, these aren't just like names of people along the way, but a history reflective of Jesus. If we want to know Jesus better, then we need to understand better where he came from. And not just the history of Israel, but how that history helps us get to know and understand him, right? So with that, Matthew chapter 1, verse 1. The record of the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Perez was the father of Hezron, and Hezron the father of Ram. Ram was the father of Amminadab, Amminadab the father of Nahshon, and Nahshon the father of Salmon. Salmon was the father of Boaz by Rahab. Boaz was the father of Obed by Ruth. And Obed, the father of Jesse. Jesse was the father of David the king. David was the father of Solomon by Bathsheba, who had been the wife of Uriah. Solomon was the father of Rehoboam. Rehoboam, the father of Abijah, and Abijah, the father of Asa. Asa was the father of Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat, the father of Joram. And Joram, the father of Uzziah. Uzziah was the father of Jotham, Jotham the father of Ahaz, and Ahaz the father of Hezekiah. Hezekiah was the father of Manasseh, Manasseh the father of Amon, and Amon the father of Josiah. Josiah became the father of Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the deportation to Babylon. After the deportation to Babylon, Jeconiah became the father of Shealtiel, and Shealtiel the father of Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel was the father of Abihud, and Abihud the father of Eliakim. And Eliakim, the father of Azor. Azor was the father of Zadok. Zadok, the father of Akim. And Akim, the father of Eliad. Eliad was the father of Eleazar. Eleazar, the father of Mathan. And Mathan, the father of Jacob. Jacob was the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, by whom Jesus was born, who is called the Messiah. So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations. From David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations. And from the deportation to Babylon to the Messiah, 14 generations. So I know it seems like a mouthful, but this is a summary of over 1,500 years worth of time, 1,500 years over that. So, you know, God is summarizing, again, what seems like, you know, kind of an exhaustive list of names. I think it's important to remember that this is scripture, and this is something that God in his infinite wisdom, you know, really in a calculated way preserved for us for a purpose. So I want to encourage fundamentally that this is a very important part of the gospel and a very important part of who Jesus is. You know, what matters to God should matter to us. And, you know, God doesn't just frivolously throw things into the Bible, and especially the ministry, the life of Jesus. So again, just to emphasize, this is, I think, a very important section that, although it can be difficult to understand lessons and difficult to pronounce the names, I just want to encourage you fundamentally, because this is in the gospel, to take this very seriously and to make an effort, you know, to know these names and to read this section. Now, part of learning a person's background, something that really helps you value a person, especially, is understanding how they've endured adversity. You know, when you understand like challenges a person has overcome, when you understand tragedies they've been through, it really helps you like respect someone's character a lot more, show them a lot more compassion, maybe relate to them a lot more. And really, it's no different with this genealogy. And the key thing about this with verse 1 is what especially helps you respect someone and appreciate who they are in terms of their character. One of the most particular things that helps with that is understanding that someone has kept commitments through adversity. So not just adversity in general, but keeping commitments through adversity. And again, that's kind of the thing with marriage, right? It's not just in health, but in sickness. It's not just for better, but it's also for worse. It's not just in richer, it's also for poorer, right? So like what matters about that commitment and what really helps you feel solidified and stable is when you recognize like this person is not going to be put off in this commitment just because things get hard, right? They're willing to continue with the promise they've made even when we're faced with adversities that could tempt that person to betray their commitment. And that leads us to verse 1. The key thing about this genealogy, especially that it doesn't go back to Adam, but starts with Abraham, the emphasis is this is God keeping commitments through the passing of time and in the face of every possible adversity, commitments he made to specific people, that God is a reliable promise keeper, which is the foundation of our relationship with him. And I kind of want to help us appreciate that. So I'm going to handle this lesson a lot differently than other kind of like PowerPoints I've put together for lessons. You know, just to kind of help us work through this at a little bit of a brisk pace, I'll put the scriptures on the board. But I'd encourage you to turn to some of these as well. But the key thing, like Abraham and David, why these two men? You know, Jesus, the Messiah, the prophesied one, the singular fulfillment of everything that God promised. That's the idea with the Messiah. The anointed one is not just in office. It's implying that he is the fulfillment of everything. He is the one singular person to complete God's promises. The son of David, the son of Abraham. So, you know, you could go back to Genesis 12, 1 through 3, where God tells Abraham that he is going to make his name great. He's going to make a great nation from him. He is going to bless those who bless them, curse those who curse him. Through him, all the families of the world will be blessed. You know, so you could look at those. And I would argue that everything God does from that point forward in Genesis 12 is God fulfilling those specific promises from Genesis 12 onward. But I think Genesis 22 is one of the clearer ones that relates especially to Jesus. This idea of like the anointed one, the Messiah. So after Abraham had been willing to sacrifice his son, Isaac, and God stopped him when he grabbed the knife. Because he obeyed in that way through faith, God promised, he swore by himself, that because he did that thing and did not even withhold his only son in relation to God's promise, and at that time Ishmael was sent away, He said he would greatly bless him, greatly multiply him, multiply his seed as the stars of the heaven, of the heavens. You know, your seed will possess the gate of their enemies, and in your seed, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. Now, in Genesis 22:18, Galatians 3 follows up on that, clarifying that when God said seed there, God meant that singularly and not as a plural, right? That God had in mind one seed, like a descendant would be the person to fulfill all of these promises being made to Abraham. That person is Jesus. And again, that was over 1,500 years ago. So there's a lot of time passing between when God makes this promise about the Messiah and then finally when Jesus comes. Well, in 2 Samuel chapter 7, I mentioned this morning as we did a study on David, that I think this is one of the most important chapters of the Old Testament. You know, as David is established as king over Israel, as he has in his mind to build a house for the Lord, a temple, but then God kind of stops him from doing that and says, no, this isn't you building me a house, this is me building you a house. Kind of as God is clarifying that, he says, I will raise up of your descendants after you. Oh, raise up your descendant, rather. I will raise up your descendant after you, who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. God made a promise to David. A promise that really hadn't reached its fulfillment until the Messiah, the One, finally came. So again, God made these promises, but what I want to spend some time focusing on is what we learn from the time invested fulfilling these promises, the adversities that were faced. And for this, you can turn in your Bibles to Deuteronomy 31. I'm going to turn there even though I have it on the board. Something I've heard before we read this passage from fathers who are giving they're talking about advice they've given their daughters when they're looking for guys, or just things I've heard guys say. And some of this isn't from Christian men. It's just things I've heard. You know, I've heard fathers talk to their daughters about the fact that, you know, every guy, no matter how scummy he is, no matter how much of a jerk he is, if a guy is romantically interested in a girl, he can be really nice to her. He can be a really good guy to her, right? So the advice I've heard is don't just get lost in the flattery of how he interacts with you or how he is around you. Watch how he treats people who get in his way. People that he's not looking for their favor, or he's just not, they don't really matter to him. What does he do when he's bothered or annoyed by people like that? How does he respond to them? Then you know his character. You know, something we're going to see in Scripture is God is going to make it very clear that Jesus and the church was always his ultimate plan. That was always the point, and he always knew that. And so Israel of the flesh, like the physical nation, God in his wisdom, even after he had invested in them for over 1,000 years, God always had in mind they were not ultimately the goal. It's what would come from them. It's where this would go with the Messiah. Well, Deuteronomy 31, as God is anticipating his relationship with physical Israel, you know, it's Deuteronomy 31, God is thinking about the future and showing us that God's not naive about what's about to happen here. You know, God's not looking on his relationship with Israel and the future of that relationship with rose-tinted glasses. Deuteronomy 32, rather, not 31. Deuteronomy 32, 21 and 22. So again, this is God looking forward. They have made me jealous with what is not God. They have provoked me to anger with their idols. And this is, God is looking forward to the future, but it's like in the perfect tense, the present and past. Just in terms of it's going to happen. It's so certain. It's as if it has happened, even though it's the future. So I will make them jealous with those who are not a people. I will provoke them to anger with a foolish nation. That's quoted in Romans as God prophesying about Jew and Gentile coming into Christ. Verse 22. For a fire is kindled in my anger, and burns to the lowest part of Sheol and consumes the earth with its yield and sets on fire the foundations of the mountains. What does God have to say about his emotions to communicate it in a way that makes sense to us? So verse 22, you know, God is anticipating with the relationship as they're just beginning their relationship. What's it going to be like? Is it going to be really rewarding? Is it going to be easy for God? You know, is he going to get some great benefit from his relationship with Israel? No, in verse 21, nothing provokes God more than idolatry. Nothing grieves God more than idolatry. And verse 22, it's not that God was going to endure just a bit of anger. He said a fire would burn to the lowest parts of Sheol and consume the earth with its yield. Did you know that God, in his infinite kind of nature, God feels emotions? And that God feels emotions more intensely than you and I have ever felt them? You know, the angriest you've ever felt, God has felt greater anger than that. The deepest grief you've ever felt, God has felt a deeper grief than that. And so again, he's anticipating with Israel, you know, this is going to be a difficult relationship, and yet God is willing to invest in it. And then now zoom forward to the time where we're getting close to the captivity of the Babylonians exiling God's people, Ezekiel prophesying in exile. At this point, when Jerusalem is not destroyed, but it's going to happen really soon. And so a portion of the Jews are already in Babylon, while some are still in Jerusalem. In Ezekiel chapter 6, you know, when Moses said that, it was about 1400 BC. When Ezekiel said this, it was about 600 BC, just about 600 BC. And so we're getting close to the destruction of Jerusalem by Babylon. You know, hundreds of years have passed with God enduring this relationship. And we need to look at what God says about how this is going and what the future is going to be like. In verse 8, he talks about how God is going to work with a remnant that ultimately will survive his coming judgments. But in verse 9, then those of you who escape will remember me among the nations where they were carried captive, because I was crushed by their adulterous heart, which has departed from me, and by their eyes which play the harlot after their idols. How does God describe his emotional condition with Israel here? And again, do you think God's being dishonest? Do you think he's like, I don't know, speaking in a way that's not true? And this, the Hebrew word that's used here for crushed, or how my heart was broken, it's literally the idea, it's kind of like a word picture word. It's like you're taking a clay jar and you're throwing it on the ground and you're shattering it to a point where it can't be repaired or put back together again. You know, so what God is saying is his relationship with Israel has impacted him. You know, it's crushed. It has completely broken his heart. I would argue adultery is the most hurtful thing a person can experience in this life. And how long had God been enduring that up to this point? Hundreds of years, anticipating that that was going to be the nature of the relationship. And we'll talk in a moment, like, why is God enduring that? When again, the whole point of this is not Israel of the flesh. The whole point is the Messiah and the church to come after. You know, Israel of the flesh is not, it's not the end goal. So why? Then you go further into Ezekiel 16. And I'll summarize the image that God gives here in this chapter is God vividly represents and illustrates his relationship with Israel. He begins the chapter picturing Jerusalem as a baby when it was born. Its umbilical cord wasn't even cut. The baby wasn't even cleaned. It was literally born and like ripped from its mother's womb and then thrown into a field to die. And God reflects that this baby was crying and squirming in its own blood. People were even passing by. Nobody cared. The baby was just writhing in its filth and blood and was going to die. But then, in verse 6, he says, he passed by. He saw this baby squirming in its blood and he said, live. Verse 7, God raised this child, raised this baby. Verse 8, he invested in this child to the point where, you know, he clothed this young woman. And as she became of age, he entered into a covenant relationship with her. Verse 9, he washed her. Verse 10 through 14, he clothed her with his glory, his wealth, his splendor, to the point where in verse 14, she became famous. Everybody knew about this woman because of what God had given her, because of what God had invested in her. But verse 15, really through near the end of the chapter, this wife of God now, what does she do with all of this? She literally takes every single thing that had been given to her, everything. And she begins to use those resources given to her by God, her husband, and she uses them to bribe men from every place they could possibly come from to have a sexual relationship with her. She uses, in verse 17, the jewels and the clothes. She dresses up rocks and wood, makes them look like men and plays pretend, and has sexual relations with objects. Verse 19 and 20, children born to her from her husband. She creates altars in front of these playthings, these images that she's created with the resources her husband gave her. She takes the children born by her husband and she slaughters them on the altars in front of these fake images. And then finally, verse 30 says, how languishing is your heart, declares the Lord, while you do all these things, the actions of a bold-faced harlot. When you built your shrines, and notice this, I don't think God is exaggerating here, as shocking as it is, at the beginning of every street, and made your high places in every square, in disdaining money, you are not like a harlot, you adulterous wife who takes strangers instead of her husband. Men give gifts to all harlots, but you give your gifts to all your lovers to bribe them to come to you from every direction for your harlotries. Thus, you are different from those women in your harlotries, in that no one plays the harlot as you do. Because you give money, and no money is given you. Thus, you are different. So, you know, not only does God anticipate this is going to be an extremely grievous relationship with Israel. Not only does he endure that relationship, but the reality of how that plays out just becomes worse and worse. And as it seems to hit rock bottom, Israel as a nation pictured as God's wife finds new, abhorrent, creative ways to continue to go deeper into depravity against her husband, with him seeing all of these things happening in his property and in his house. All of these things are happening. And all of this in chapter 37, as we start to think about this with some relevance, go to chapter 37. I would argue this should change when we kind of bear this in mind and thinking about God as a personal being who does express emotion and feels emotion and who is working hard to help us understand the emotions that he's facing, it should create a different context of tone when we read the promises that are related to Abraham and David and how determined God is that through this, with this woman, he is going to fulfill those promises, both to Abraham and David. And this relates again to the genealogy as pointing to God enduring all the things of this time frame to prove something about his faithfulness for us. Ezekiel 37, 23 through 28, there's 14 will statements here that are easy to overlook. And I want to try to read this with a tone that I think is a more appropriate tone for what God is really getting at here. That this isn't just a passive promise of like, okay, you know, this is a prophet. Yeah, and you know, the prophets, they talk about Jesus. So, you know, here's just another one of those promises God is making. I would argue again that to think of this as just some passively spoken prophecy is entirely insufficient. Ezekiel 37, 23 through 28. With all this in view, with the relationship being described as it was in chapter 16, chapter 6, Deuteronomy, Ezekiel 37, I will vindicate the holiness of my great name, which has been profaned among the nations, which you profaned in their midst. Then the nations will know that I am the Lord, declares the Lord God, when I prove myself holy among you in their sight. For I will take you from the nations, gather you from all the lands, and bring you into your own land. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm reading a chapter before. Verse 23 of chapter 37. If you were confused, you had the right to be confused. Chapter 37, verse 23. They will no longer defile themselves with their idols, or with their detestable things, or with any of their transgressions, but I will deliver them from all their dwelling places in which they have sinned, and will cleanse them. And they will be my people, and I will be their God. My servant David will be king over them, and they will all have one shepherd. And they will walk in my ordinances and keep my statutes and observe them. They will live on the land that I gave to Jacob my servant, as they're about to be exiled out of it here. Or rather, this is post-destruction of Jerusalem at this point. They've been exiled entirely. Verse 25, they will live on the land that I gave to Jacob my servant, in which your fathers lived, and they will live on it, they and their sons' sons, forever. And David my servant will be their prince forever. I will make a covenant of peace with them, as now there's been this intense hostility. It will be an everlasting covenant with them, and I will place them and multiply them, and will set my sanctuary in their midst forever, as the temple has been destroyed now by Babylon. Verse 27. My dwelling place also will be with them, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. And the nations will know that I am the Lord, who sanctifies in Israel, when my sanctuary is in their midst forever. You know, when we understand the context of what God has endured, how should we read something like that? You know, that with this woman that he described in Ezekiel 16, this relationship he's been enduring, that God is still determined to win the willful affection of that woman. And you know what the point is of that genealogy and the point of Acts chapter 2? The gospel begins in Jerusalem, the city pictured in Ezekiel 16. You know what the point is? God won that woman. He did it. All those years of adversity, all that pain, the broken heart, the grief, all the investment that seemed to have no fair payoff, he did it. Because God's faithfulness to his promises is not in vain. So how is this, you know, kind of looking even more closely, how is this relevant to Romans 9? You know, as Romans 9, what Paul is trying to work out here is, okay, the physical Jews have been rejected, and now it's people of faith, which can be Jew and Gentile. So the fact that the physical nation of the Jews have been rejected, has his promises failed? You know, because it's like those promises were to Israel. They were to the Jewish people. So if there's been a rejection of the physical nation, how do we kind of work out the fact that kind of seems like that's contradicting some of these things that God said he would do? And what Paul is doing is trying to bring out the fact here that God did not fail, but did everything exactly as he said he would, and that the true Israel has always been people of faith. And he eventually gets to this point. What if God, although willing to demonstrate his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much patience vessels of wrath prepared for destruction? And by the way, he's talking about the physical Jews there, Israel of the flesh. What he's saying is, they were always doomed to destruction. That nation was always going to fail. That was never the end goal. And God was willing at many points to destroy the nation. And it would have been just and right for him to do it. In Ezekiel 20, God even says that in Egypt, before the Exodus, something we don't read in Exodus, in Ezekiel 20, God reflects on their history of idolatry, and he says that Moses told Israel in Egypt, get rid of your idols and I'll deliver you. And in Ezekiel 20, God says, they did not do it. And he determined to wipe them out as a nation in Egypt. But he said, but for the sake of my great name, I restrain myself. And again, what God is doing in Ezekiel 20 is he's trying to make the point, like, this has been the relationship from the beginning. Dealing with idolatry and spiritual adultery, that's been my relationship with Israel from before you can even think. Before the Exodus ever happened, before we got to Sinai, they were idolaters and they never stopped. What if God, being willing to make his wrath known, endured with much patience these vessels of wrath? Why? He did so to make known the riches of his glory, that is, his grace, the riches of his patience, the power of his promises, to make known the riches of his glory upon vessels of mercy, which he prepared beforehand for glory, even us, whom he also called, not from among the Jews only, but also from among the Gentiles. And further in Galatians 3, Paul, in a very similar point, says that, you know what, Israel of the flesh, they are not the true lineage of Abraham. You know who is? People who are baptized into Christ. If you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's descendants, heirs according to promise. Who is the genealogy really for in Matthew 1? Who would be the long-term true descendants of Abraham? Do you think God was like ignorant of what he was doing and what Paul would write in Romans and Galatians about the fact that the physical nation of the Jews were never the real goal? It was always that we would become the true heirs of the promises made to Abraham. We would be the true fulfillment of the promises made to David. And what God was really doing all along was proving his character to us and what he is willing to do with us. So I want to think about this practically for just a couple minutes. I want to illustrate this with something that may seem kind of silly. I used to watch a lot of the Antique Roadshow. I don't know if most of you know about that. It's a show that like older people would watch, and I would watch it with my grandmother. But it was basically a show where people would bring junk, or what might not be junk, and they would bring it to an appraiser who had some expertise in like historical things. And anyway, they'd bring their stuff to an appraiser and kind of see, is this worth anything? Is this maybe, you know, does this have a history that I didn't know about and now this is actually worth a lot of money? Well, a lot of times someone has something that they thought really wasn't worth very much. Maybe it's a jar or a cup or a painting, just something that they didn't think really had value until they brought it to an appraiser. And what does he do? He talks about its history, its origin, and who it was who made it, the craftsmanship, the material. So, you know, if it was from someone famous, that increases the value. If it took a lot of time to make and a lot of craftsmanship went into it, it's really rare, that increases its value. If it has a rich history, let's say it's been through some things, right? Like it's a World War II relic, a World War I, whatever. If it has a particularly unique history, that increases its value. How valuable should Jesus be to us? You know, Jesus talked about the kingdom is like a treasure hidden in a field. Hidden. But when that person finds it, who recognizes its value, he goes away and sells all that he has to buy the field. God's left it up to us. What kind of value does Jesus have to you? Because if we aren't measuring the value of Christ by what God has invested, the fact that this is God carefully crafting salvation over thousands of years for us to understand its value, to understand Jesus' teaching, his ministry, to understand the very brief textual space given to his death, that the Old Testament enlightens us to understand the enormity of Jesus' ministry beyond what is apparent on only a cursory reading. But I want you to think about this as well. Is any sin too big for God to deal with? You realize what God proved in the genealogy leading up to Jesus, right? You know, Hundreds of years had passed with Israel steeped in idolatry, steeped endlessly in idolatry. Hundreds of years, generation after generation, the gospel solved that problem. Listen, there's no sin we can get entangled in that will ever be as entrenched in our being as idolatry was in Israel in the Old Testament. There's no habit we have that we've been in it too long. It's just, it's too much a part of our character. Our thinking just, we're so entrenched in a way of thinking that is so opposed to purity and God's will, whatever. If God could solve the problem of Israel's idolatry and convert that woman from Ezekiel and Deuteronomy and fix that relationship, then for sure what he's demonstrated, the riches of his mercy, not just that he will be merciful, but that mercy can accomplish something. That God is able to do the things he's proven he's able to do. The other side of this is how valuable we are to God. Did you know that genealogy is showing how much God has given to show you and me how valuable we are to him? You know, Paul prayed in Ephesians chapter 1 that we would know what are the riches and the glory of his inheritance in the saints. And leading up to that, it talks about how God predestined to redeem us and invested from the beginning of time to show us just how valuable we are to him. We need to open our eyes and open our ears to understand how valuable we are to God. Finally, go back to Matthew 1, verse 17. Just this little snippet at the end. 14 generations, 14 generations, 14 generations. This is a lot of time. But did you catch the symmetry? The order? You know, was everyone in this genealogy obedient and righteous? No. But did it fall out of the order of God's plan because of that? Did turbulent times mean God has lost control? So verse 17, if God on this grand scale could maintain purpose and order, even when there's times like the exile to Babylon and kings who shut the doors of the temple and kings who spread injustice in Israel, if that cannot bring God's plan out of its order, can our sin do that? Do you just repent and keep seeking him? Do you think God, as he did here, in the end, will be able to help us look back and see that everything, God was able to bring everything into order with his plan? Just like by the time we get to Jesus, we're able to realize all of the chaos, the time passing, it never fell beyond God's purpose. It never fell out of the order of his plan. We just need to invest more trust in God. You know, no matter how chaotic things get, no matter how uncertain things seem, things never fall out of the order of God's ability, even when our circumstances blind us to the bigger picture. God never loses sight. God never allows things to go further than what he can accomplish, what he can use to accomplish his purpose. That's where we'll stop the lesson. There's actually more to say. I'm stopping the lesson there. I'll go ahead and show you. I had a bunch of extra points related to the names that are given there. We're not going to go into them because the lesson has made the points well enough already. But there's just this aspect of Matthew is saturated with points to be made that are practical, relevant, and encouraging. And so I encourage you, when you read the genealogy in Matthew chapter 1, 1 through 17, think about it personally. Think about what is proven through the passing of time in relation to God's promises and how much that should mean for a relationship to Jesus himself. Let's end the lesson there, and if you'll pray with me, we'll pray before the invitation song.